It is Saturday, June. Ben didn't edit the show page. It's not June, is it?
I did indeed. I said July. Oh, never mind.
It says it right there. It is Saturday, July 28th, 2012. We are broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio. My name's Lyle Troxell in the air with me. Our geeks that I'll introduce in just a moment. But first, I want to let you know that you're listening to Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridges and gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on Geek Speak, in the first half, we'll be covering geek news, and in the second half, search engine optimization as requested by our audience with author Eric Enga. Geek Speak today is, of course, live as it is every week, and in the air with me is Mr. Ben Jaffe. He's a web instructor and world traveler.
Hey there.
I love it when you edit the show pages because it's wonderful to get prepared.
I edited like five of the six places I needed to edit.
we also have Lindsay Lonnie. She's a software engineer. Hello.
Good morning.
And Eric Enga, CEO of Stone Temple Consulting. Eric, you with us on the phone?
I am with you on the phone. Looking forward to the show today.
Great. Well, we will be talking about search engine optimization in about a half an hour, 24 minutes or so. But please feel free to participate in the news that we talk about during the week. Okay.
Absolutely.
Great. So, Ben, what's going on with Kepler?
So, I talk about Kepler a lot. Kepler is basically a satellite that's orbiting the Earth, and it's looking at the brightness levels, the light levels of a whole bunch of different stars, something like 10,000, 30,000 different stars. And whenever those light levels change, what we can do is we can intuit that something passed in front of the star, right? Mm-hmm. If they go down and they go back up. What we're doing is we're looking for exoplanets, for planets that are outside of our solar system orbiting other stars. Now, the story that I found is that Kepler-30, which is one of the systems that we're monitoring, the planets themselves, they're not actually remarkable or unusual. They're two giant Jupiter kind of shaped things and one what we call a super Earth, which is much larger than Earth, but kind of Earth-like, right? Mm-hmm. But it's not the planets that are unusual. It's that our solar system, our planets orbit around the sun's equator to a ridiculous degree of precision. Like, all of our planets are pretty much in the same plane, and that's in line with the plane of the sun's equator, which is when it rotates.
The basic idea is that as the sun formed, its cloud condensed into a rotating disk, and all the planets came out of that. Therefore, we're still in the same plane.
Yeah,
there's one that's not in the same plane.
Pluto is not, and I think it's one of the outer ones. But for the most part, yeah, actually, Pluto's way out.
Yeah,
out of the loop. But Pluto's not a planet anymore,
right,
so
right.
Hey, there we go. But it turns out that we've been finding a lot of planets at very odd angles to their parent stars, and so one of the questions has been, are there other planets and systems like that, right? Or are we pretty much the only one that we found? And it turns out now we've found one that where all of the planets are within 1 degree of precision of the actual star and the equator of the star.
See, the thing I don't understand about this is that, how long does it take Jupiter to orbit the sun? You'd think that it takes you 100 years or so to find out how many planets are around the sun if you only can determine that by its intersection of the sun's light
to
us.
Yes, but that's some solar systems. We've got solar systems where planets are orbiting much, much faster.
They're closer.
Those are the ones we're finding.
Right.
I'm not saying that there aren't solar systems that have planets way far out, right? But they're going to be more difficult to detect because the planets aren't going to occlude the sun as much or the star as much. And additionally, of course, they take longer to orbit, and so we're going to see those dips in a regular pattern that spans years and years and years instead of a year or 2 years. But really quickly, here's the really cool thing about it. We figured it out, so we can't optically image these stars because they're so far away. We can just look at the light. It turns out that we were able to figure out that these planets are all occluding the sun or the star right over a star spot. Because the light output of the star would go down, and then it would go up a little bit as the planet went in front of the sunspot because it's not blocking as much light from the sunspot area.
I see.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And because all of the planets are passing the same sunspot and that star is rotating, we can therefore assume that all of the planets are passing in front of the sunspot as it rotates, and the sunspot's roughly on the equator.
Oh, that's really cool.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, it's wonderful. I love how much we're able to infer from this pinpoint of light.
Yeah, it's all inference.
Yeah.
It's all inference, and
it's not like we can see the sunspot. We just figure, oh, well, if it's passing in front and it goes up again, it means that there was already a dark spot there. That's wonderful.
Science is so cool. So I'll put that story up on the website.
As we do everything, geekspeak.org. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi.
Good morning. Good morning. Good morning. What's up with you?
I've got a couple things. I'm going to back-to-back. Public service announcements.
All right, I love those.
So, yeah. Have you heard of the Internet Defense League?
Yes.
IDL? Okay.
I haven't.
But please tell us what it is.
I was just going to mention it briefly. So, I don't know, Wayback Machine, if you recall SOPA and PIPA, the bills that media was trying to get passed, and there was an Internet going dark. A bunch of websites shut down in protest of these bills. It got a lot of public attention. So, this group, it's a grassroots group called IDL, Internet Defense League. They're trying to create the equivalent of a bat signal for the internet and gather a bunch of people together so that we can act more quickly if something like this comes up again.
Right.
Solidarity and all that sort of stuff. So I just wanted to mention it so people can go check it out.
Cool.
I think Reddit and some other ones are already on board and people aren't involved crossover like with EFF.
The idea is to actually have a plan of action when a plan of action is required.
Right? Exactly.
That's a very cool idea.
Yeah.
I was thinking about that as we were developing the new GeekSpeak website. We really should have the ability to make the site black. You know, something that can be set at a certain time and date and occur based off of, a group that we want to support.
Right.
But in any case.
Have a page that has some sort of announcement.
You know? Yeah. Exactly. Okay, so the Internet Defense League, you find this more at geekspeak.org after today's show.
And then the public service announcement. Have you seen those Buckyballs toys that people put on their desks at work and things like that? They're small, round, rare earth magnets that each one is about a quarter inch in diameter. You can buy bigger ones and stuff like that. They're just fun to play with. But
you're just talking about a collection of rare earth magnets.
Right.
Okay.
Exactly.
Oh, are these magnets inside a shield so they're north and south is kind of hidden from you? They always... No?
No.
Okay.
They're loose.
All right.
So the problem with that is that children are ingesting them and it's causing intestines to pinch and surgeries and things like that.
We used rare earth magnets at work at UCSC, and I'm always telling students when I loan them out to people because we hang out with them, and I'm always saying, don't let kids, And the last time I said, oh, and there's one thing about these, and the student looked at me and said, don't let a kid swallow them. I know, Lyle, you say it all the time.
Yeah.
And the issue is that these things attract each other really, really well, and they're small. So you eat one, no big deal, you're going to pass it after a few days. But if you wait a few hours and then you eat another one, your intestines actually bump into each other, and the magnets will collide and connect to each other and actually pierce your intestines potentially, but definitely won't leave your body. And it's very, very bad. So don't swallow magnets, kids.
Right.
Is that the PSA?
Essentially, so back in November, they issued a public service announcement and they had to put a bunch of warnings. The distributors are Maxfield and Overton. So they did all the things they were supposed to do and said, these are not toys. They're for adults, not for children. But apparently they've gotten a lot more calls about kids getting sick and stuff like that because they get a hold of them.
Mm-hmm.
It's so shiny. It looks like candy. And so essentially the Consumer Product Safety Commission, the CPSC, ordered a halt on the sale of Buckyballs.
No.
It says that, I know. And so they had Maxfield and Overton have started a Save Our Balls campaign that you can go online and check out their website, and they're trying to say that it's unfair that the government's forcing them to do this because it's marketed at adults.
Right.
So it's just kind of an interesting...
Well, it really is just a warning thing in a lot of sense. I mean, we all know that lasers are dangerous, right? Because every time they're packaged anywhere, they say, careful, your eye can be killed, So there's this whole fear about laser pointers, and because of that, parents know not to let kids play with it without supervising and all these things. They're not actually very dangerous. The thing that can be dangerous with laser pointers is if you aim it at your eye and you do it for a while, right? That's what's dangerous. The flash in the eye really quick is actually that big of a deal. So it's interesting that all that would have to really happen is if all magnets were sold that have a certain size and shape and everything had these major warnings on it, we'd have enough of an understanding that they're dangerous. Unfortunately, they're not that way. It's easy to buy them and see them and not have that effect. So if you interact with kids a lot, keep track of magnets. Magnets can be dangerous. These really small ones we're talking about.
Yeah.
And they're everywhere, of course. They're in our earphones right now.
They're gnarly. Yeah, yeah. A lot of times people will put one on one side of the ear and then the other on the other side of the ear. And it doesn't hurt until they start attracting. And it's the inverse. I think is it the inverse square law with magnets?
The distance? Yeah, sure.
Or the dipole. It might be different. But anyway, yeah. So the closer you get them, the seriously stronger they become, right? You get them half the distance.
Are you talking about you're wearing this stuff as jewelry?
I don't.
Okay.
But some people.
Do you ever swallow them? Because that's dangerous.
I didn't know.
Thank you, Lindsay, for both of those. What's up with the Trojan security? Or Mac security?
So as it turns, you gave the story. Sorry right there. That. No, it's okay. New Mac malware. Basically, there's some new Mac malware that spies on you via a couple different applications. Audium, which is a chat client, Firefox, Safari, which are both web browsers, and Skype, right? So basically what will happen is if this gets installed on your app on your computer, it's actually executed on a user account with admin privileges, but you don't have to interact with it. And that's kind of scary. So up until now, most Mac issues, security issues, have been things where, you know, you run something, it asks you for your admin password, you type in your admin password, and then you have some kind of virus. In this situation, it can actually install itself silently.
How is it doing that?
I am not sure. Probably some specific security vulnerability in the operating system or Yeah, exactly. So that's kind of bad news bears. If you have some kind of
How do you know if you have this virus already? This Trojan.
There are a couple things. You can look for a couple folders or files that have been created. That's one. Two, you can install antivirus software that has updated definitions. I would recommend that.
You know, for years we've kind of said, here on the Mac, don't worry about it. Mm-hmm. But it's time now to worry.
It's time now to start worrying. Because
you should have antivirus on your Mac.
So this one has yet to be found in the wild.
Right.
It's not in the wild. It's at VirusTotal, which is a service that you use to analyze suspicious files, URLs, things like that, right? So it exists. It's not in the wild yet,
that we know.
Right. Exactly. But if it becomes a virus in the wild, then all of a sudden you might
Since it's a YeeSpeak's recommendation to have antivirus on your Mac and you have a Mac in front of you, what antivirus are you running, Ben?
I'm actually not running antivirus.
Gee,
right now.
Me neither.
Yeah,
what
I know.
A drag.
So it's kind of like one of those colloquially you'll be okay, but technically you really shouldn't do that kind of things.
Right.
Like human beings are lazy. That includes me.
Let's go for Sophos. I'll recommend Sophos on this program.
Yeah. Sophos.
So this is, you know, you need to get a paid application that will protect your computer.
There are some
highly recommend
ones.
It. There are good wood free ones.
Is AVG for the Mac?
I don't know. I've never needed to look. But what I suggest, we use Sophos at UCSC. That's why I recommend it. Only because I can install it on this machine because it's a machine for work as well.
AVG launches free security software for Mac OS X. mid-2010.
So AVG is available too. We like AVG because it's got a free version. Most of these companies have a bit of free, right? They'll normally give you a trial period. But I'm kind of in the space of, I don't really want to play with the free, figure out what works this week, how do you download it. I'm kind of into the, let's pay some money for some good software. I've matured as a geek person.
Well, do you use Wikipedia or do you pay for encyclopedias?
I always pay for Wikipedia when they ask.
Wait, what?
How's that? Wikipedia asks for donations and I submit.
So you could also get free malware protection software and then donate or something.
I see
what you're saying. Sometimes free software is amazing because it has a huge community to support it. But then sometimes free software is not so great.
And to me, it's not about whether there's better free software. I think there probably is amazingly good antivirus for the Macintosh that's free. I have no doubt that exists.
Yeah.
I don't actually technically know what it is right now. But
same
I know
here.
Sophos makes a living off of selling their antivirus. Now, the other thing about antivirus, of course, is that you don't really technically don't really want a really big company. You want a very effective small company. Because the people that make exploits, viruses, Trojans, things like that, always test it against the big guys.
Yeah.
So by the time they're launching in the wild, they know that it doesn't, you know, McAfee won't catch it.
And same with
But it's
Norton.
Only a short period of time until McAfee does catch it and Norton does catch it. You know, all these companies actually catch it. So find an antivirus company you like. The big thing for me is don't go for companies that spam you a lot. You know, go to them.
On the other side of things, though, sometimes going with a big established company cannot be the best idea ever. Like my experiences with Norton antivirus on the Windows side have been absolutely horrible because it's gargantuan. It's huge. What I want is a lean, small antivirus piece of antivirus.
Switch to Ubuntu.
Software. Ubuntu doesn't.
Oh, you're not talking about operating system. You're talking about virus protection. Okay, gotcha. I thought you were talking about Microsoft being bloated.
Oh, no. I'm running the Norton operating system. Haven't you heard of that?
There is a Norton. Yeah,
no, there is not.
Long ago.
Anyway, so yeah, just be aware that, and also recently, I think Apple on its website changed the verbiage exactly.
Yep. Yeah,
they used
that.
To say something like,
"No Mac, no viruses on Macintosh."
Yeah, you don't have to worry about virus. And now they say like it's safer out of the box or something like that.
Right. you don't get infected in 20 minutes. It'll take a month.
Exactly.
So make sure you're getting antivirus on your Macintosh. Definitely on your Windows machine.
Yes.
There's really no way you can be protected enough without having software on top of it helping you, mm-hmm. because the world is complicated enough, unfortunately.
Yeah. I have a piece of software called Little Snitch installed, and mm-hmm. that allows me to see all of my outgoing traffic and block it if I choose to.
Right.
So I add things to a whitelist. The reason that would actually help me in this situation is the backdoor component actually of the Trojan calls home to a specific IP address.
Right. So
in
see that
case,
emerge.
Mm-hmm. If I see that pop up, I'll say, wait a second.
Assuming they don't modify the virus to turn off the Little Snitch and
exactly.
make it invisible.
So,
all right, let's move on because we've gotten so technical so quickly.
So tired of security.
Let's talk about the government doing spyware, shall we?
Okay.
That's
good.
So there's a UK-based corporation. I don't know if it's actually a corporation, but Gamma International. They sell a product called FinFisher. It's spyware, which they supposedly sell to governments, which is supposed to be used against criminals. But apparently they were pitching to the Egyptian state security before the revolution happened. And in December, there's an WikiLeaks essentially published a promotional video showing how police could plant this product from FinFisher on a target's computer. So their advertisement, what it does is if it's installed, it can take remote control of the computer, copy files, intercept Skype calls, and log all the keystrokes. So human rights organizations have been saying, you know, that regulations should be created so that people can't create and purchase stuff like this, because it's a violation of your basic rights to have something like this installed in your computer. And essentially, there's no regulation saying that you have to be proven to be a criminal or have some sort of case against you in order to have this installed. It can be, it's the internet, so it can be done across borders and things like that. But until recently, nobody could get a hold of this to see how it works, and nobody could catch it out in the wild. But a handful of Bahraini activists, including a naturalized U.S. citizen, received emails with suspicious attachments, and then they forwarded them to Bloomberg News. And Bloomberg sent them to Berkeley and San Francisco and different computer science analysts to take a look at this, and it turned out it was a Trojan.
Mm-hmm.
And that a lot of the stuff within the Trojan could be associated. They haven't proven one way or the other, because they haven't taken ownership of it, of course, that it's a FinFisher product.
Right.
And they observed it, and essentially it does the same thing like what you're talking about with this Mac. You know, it calls home to a certain IP address, mm-hmm. and sends a bunch of information. And so these five people, they didn't know of any criminal cases that they had against them. They didn't even know that anyone would be observing them. They were just activists. One of them lives in London. So Martin J. Munch, he's an ex-hacker turned executive, and he's the one that runs this company that created this software. But they say they comply with all export regulations and things like that, too. And it's just interesting to me
Absolutely.
To think what kind of regulations would need to happen government-wise, you know,
right,
when it's across borders like that.
Absolutely. And, I mean, the wiretapping laws that we have in the federal government don't really cover this kind of thing. It gets more complicated than that quickly.
Right.
And we've seen, you know, that quite a few exploits out in the wild are actually government-based.
Right.
So, fascinating. I love the stories. I'm in the space where it's... I wouldn't say I'm scared of my computer. I don't wear an aluminum hat when I'm typing, but there's definitely that aspect that it can be viewing you all the time. It kind of thinks about who you are. That there's that public aspect of anything on a computer.
Right.
And I definitely, if somebody right now wanted to target me, for example, I know they'd be able to get on my computer and do something. Right? There's enough exploits in software just mm-hmm. Out of the bat. Also, like, I go to lunch sometimes. I leave the machine in my office, right? It's got a firewall port. Well, there you go. Actually, it doesn't.
Yeah, well, anonymity and all this is a wonderful thing. This is Eric jumping in.
Yeah, Eric, go ahead.
You know, I mean, as an individual, you hope you're just not important enough to get targeted.
Exactly.
Mass scale things happen. It's really scary.
Yeah, exactly. If you have, for example, with passwords, same thing. If you have a really, really long password, everything is crackable, or you know, people can figure it out. But if you're not the lowest hanging fruit or anywhere near the bottom of the tree, no one's going to bother.
Well, if you have a long enough password that's, you know, pseudo random, it's like the end of the universe is going to happen before it gets cracked. So there's that aspect.
It's statistically improbable, but it's still possible. The point is, like, you can never get to an impossible.
You know,
like, it's impossible
to. Ben, I get from the geek and mathematics perspective that yes, it's possible, but it's so improbable that it's impossible.
Okay, I agree with you there.
If the password's long enough, but we won't get into the details of that. But good point.
But same with having a machine. You know, like, you can have really hardened security, whatever antivirus is the best out there, and everything. But there's always going to be some way to get into it. The question is whether or not anyone will figure it out, and
absolutely,
with whether anyone will bother to try.
And if it's harder
to worth it.
Yeah,
exactly.
If it's worth it. Right, right. Yeah, and so, like, definitely, Ben, I get that perspective of, like, well, I don't have very much money in the bank, and I have a pretty good password, so I'm definitely not the low fruit, right?
Not at all.
there you go. It's just not, it's not worth it, really.
Mm-hmm.
Eric, thanks for chiming in. Please feel free. We'll be continuing our search engine optimization conversation in just a minute. Eric Inga is also in the virtual house with us today, but let's go ahead and talk about FAA.
The virtual house. Ha,
does
I like
work?
It. Yeah. So the FAA now has some new software that they're working on, and it's going to basically be used for routing planes and dealing with all the stuff that they used to use radar and other things for. It's called ADS-B, stands for Automatic Dependent Surveillance Broadcast System. So it's basically the replacement for the way they're doing all of this stuff, but it turns out at the Black Hat conference, a computer scientist showed a security vulnerability where not necessarily you being able to get information about planes out of the system,
mm-hmm,
but you being able to put information about planes into the system. Basically, it allows you, through this security exploit, to generate fake planes. And so one of the biggest issues is, what if someone decides to generate a million different fake planes in random locations throughout U.S. airspace? What's going to happen?
That'd be a problem.
Well, yeah. Like, real planes are going to be diverted to avoid fake planes, and the air traffic controllers are going to have to take everyone out of the air.
And it'll be a bad day for air traffic controllers.
It'll be a really bad... Yeah, they already have the most stressful job,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
Job description ever.
I don't know
ever.
Why, when you're directing hundreds of people around in giant metal boxes
and
in the air.
And you just cannot make a mistake.
Yeah, no mistakes, please.
Whatever. No mistakes, please. They tell you that at the training. So anyway, it's not so good. Again, one of those examples of security issues that may not be an issue ever, but I mean...
Oh, I think it's very well could.
That's a high profile thing. It's effectively the equivalent of a huge denial of service attack,
right?
A DDoS.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely.
It's exactly.
Same
you just put a whole bunch of stuff in there, and then you can't separate the real from the fake, and the system gets overloaded.
And I'm assuming that will be repaired. That vulnerability.
Yes, I'm sure it will. See, that's why we have these security conferences, or one of the reasons we have them, is to poke holes in software that's about to come out or that's just come out, so that way the vendor can actually fix them.
Let's talk about hardware vulnerabilities now. Lindsay, you've got a great story. We'll close the geek news with it today.
Oh, wow.
Fantastic.
Oh, you like this one?
Oh, I do. It's horribly great.
So, how a 3-year-old can open a gun safe. Essentially, the safes that you can buy off the shelf at places like, you know, Target and Walmart, you know, usually they're like $75 to $130, and they're just designed like, they're like the ones you have in a hotel room where it's a small safe, and usually it's a fingerprint, a key lock, biometric stuff, and essentially they have videos on this website of small children being able to open these by just either shaking them vigorously, sticking paper clips into the locks, breaking off the fingerprint pad, and then manipulating what's underneath it. And so it's just, they're not that safe.
Right.
So that's my other public service announcement with that part. So
that's the thing is, because you'd think, you know, okay, I've got a handgun at home and the baby's going to be visiting, or I'm going to have a child. Let's go ahead and get a safe. So you go down and you spend $100, you get a safe. And okay, phew, that's what a relief. And then all they have to do is come over with like large, Duplo blocks and just smash it open.
Right. I mean, you know, what's funny, Lindsay and I were talking about fuzz testing at the beginning, which is basically if you want to test software, you just give it a bunch of invalid, unexpected, random data to the inputs of the computer program and then see if something unexpected happens. In real life, life with humans.
Just give it to a three-year-old.
Yeah, you give it to a three-year-old, and the three-year-old will just, like, turn it upside down, smash it on a brick, smash it on the carpet.
Push 0000.
0000,
yeah. Opens. That's the master code.
Oh, man. So yeah, basically a little exercise
so
monkeys.
Safe. So you got to get something that's tested. And that's the thing that's so frustrating is that you think that a responsible parent, they get a safe for the things they don't want the kids to get involved with, you know?
And that's the inherent trust we have in these companies that make these safes.
In reality, it's just safer to put it on the top shelf of your closet until at least they're seven.
So if you're the owner of a gun safe manufacturing company, employ some three-year-olds, test out your safes.
How about? I guess then what you need to do if you've got a gun safe, you've got a safe in general that you want kids to stay out of, make sure to go check on reviews and maybe even talk to a locksmith and see if they're as safe as you think they are. They probably aren't. But
there's...
You had one more story about gun safety, and this is a little crazy, but go ahead and do this one too, and then we really will go on with the show.
Okay. There was a forum post on a 3D printer site that shows a .22 caliber pistol that was formed by a 3D printer, so essentially made of plastic, the lower receiver, but the upper is the normal commercial. So essentially the barrel is metal, but it's a plastic gun otherwise.
Oh, okay.
But the interesting part of that is that the way you qualify gun for legal purposes involves the lower part, the handle of the gun. So it's not technically a gun, and you don't need a license
because
to
you
carry
can print it yourself.
Like that because you printed it yourself.
That's so the laws about firearms are so ridiculous in this country. 3D printers specifically is a desktop device that puts a whole bunch of dots of plastic and eventually builds up a model of something. And now you can print guns, except for the barrel and probably the firing pin. I would assume the firing pin would have to be a piece of metal as well.
Probably.
That's the part that impacts the back of the bullet to make it explode. This is Geek Speak. We are doing a Geek Bit in just a second. In fact, we're going to do two of them, one with Ben, one with me, and someone else. The Geek Bit is, of course, a visual reference to something that you can't really experience on the radio, and we urge you to go to our website to fully experience what we're talking about. In the air with me is Lindsay Lonnie and also Ben Jaffe. My name is Lyle Troxell. And in just a minute, we're going to be inviting Eric and Inga to talk about search engine optimization. Ben, your Geek Bit.
My Geek Bit. So 2 decades ago, Discovery Channel and the Lowell Observatory spent $53 million and built a telescope. It took about 20 years, but we got our first images back from it, and it is the one of the largest privately funded telescopes. It's actually the fifth largest telescope in the U.S. that's funded entirely without state or federal money. It's pretty cool, and the pictures look really good. So
What's the name of the telescope?
The Discovery Channel telescope.
Okay, so we'll see a lot more images of that.
Yes,
and some
indeed.
Of them are for epicgeekspeak.org.
It's in Arizona. If anyone lives near Happy Jack, Arizona, I have no idea where that is, but
so
go look at it.
What I would recommend is this wonderful video. It's been going around the YouTubes, about 7 million viewers so far. A conversation with my 12-year-old self. Ben, have you seen this?
No.
Okay, so a 12-year-old kid records an interview with himself talking to himself in the future. And then 20 years passes, and the guy happens to be a filmmaker, and he edits together the rest of the conversation.
Whoa.
So, Elias, hi, Elias, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi.
So, how old are you, Elias?
12.
And what are you doing here today in the other room while we're doing GeekSpeak?
Filming myself.
And so, you're going to kind of emulate this piece in the sense that you'll interview yourself in the future, potentially?
Yes.
Okay, I love it. So when you get all this footage on the camera, make sure to give me a copy, so at least there's two copies, so that in 20 years we can find it and do that. Awesome.
Okay.
All right, thank you very much. So that's the whole conversation that currently exists, the one that's not going to be 20 years from now. And so, Elias, we'll check back with you, right, in about 20 years?
Okay.
Okay, great. Talk to you then. And Lindsay, you got one Geek Bit as well?
Sure. Have you heard of the Unicub by Honda? It's a personal mobility device, and it's, you know, the latest and greatest thing, better than a Segway. It essentially looks like a trash compactor. It's really small and narrow, and you just sit on it, and it has two wheels, and you can roll around your office or wherever you are, and it's not wide or whatever, but it's kind of funny looking.
It's a seated Segway?
It's a seated device like a Segway. So it's a personal mobility device.
Okay.
And it's just this little white thing with a supposedly very comfortable seat. So you sit instead of standing.
Do you lean forward and backward and everything to move?
Exactly.
So it is kind of a Segway.
A Segway. Yes, it kind of is a Segway. But better, new and improved.
Thank you so much for the Geek Bits. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Lindsay Lonnie. Lindsay Lonnie, and Ben Jaffe. And via phone, we have Eric Inga. Eric is the author of first and second edition of The Art of SEO, Mastering Search Engine Optimization, published by O'Reilly. And Eric, thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure. Glad to join.
So I've been a web developer since I got out of college, I've got a pretty good understanding of how the web works. And I even understand how search engines work to some degree. But I have to say, when people tell me, oh, I just had a class on SEO and this company wants to sell us this feature and they want us to build some linked lists and, oh, we need to get our keywords up in the headers, I cringe because I feel like there's so much false information about search engine optimization. So a couple weeks ago when somebody called me up on the show and said, hey, I'm trying to get my site more public, I said, create good content. And they said, well, I learned some stuff about keywords. And I said, stop, no, that stuff is bogus. And they said, well, it can't be totally bogus. And I thought about it and said, well, you know what, that's true. Let's have a whole episode of Geek Speak talking about search engine optimization. So, of course, I have you, the expert on search engine optimization. So thank you for being here. First off, you have a slightly different perspective on what search engine optimization is compared to what I think of it is. So can you give us your definition?
Sure. So the sad part is that for a lot of people, as soon as you talk about search engine optimization, which we also abbreviate SEO, they think about manipulation and trying to do things to fool search engines into giving you traffic that you don't deserve.
Right.
And that's one source of disinformation out there that you referred to. The other major source of disinformation is that there are practices that used to work 10 years ago that don't work today, and people haven't, everybody hasn't figured that out yet. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of issues. But at the end of the day, to me, search engine optimization in the ideal sense is producing great content, doing a few things just to be aware of search engine limitations and understanding your content, and then promoting it effectively. That's a very high-level definition. I'm happy to go into detail on any piece of that if you like.
Let's go into some background about the search engines themselves. And when we talk about search engine optimization, we're really talking about Google. Right. I mean, sure, we'll mention Bing, sure, and we'll mention Yahoo, but we're talking about Google because that's the market. But
yeah, I mean, it's 80% of the traffic. It depends on who you see and who you reference. But
right,
in my world, I think of it as 80% of the search traffic.
Right. So it's an important one to pay attention to. And
yeah,
Google has a whole space on their site devoted, support pages and such, devoted to making your site function well with their search engine. Right. They actually kind of provide tips and tricks and help. Correct.
They do, and there is a lot of good wisdom to be found on those pages. Google, of course, also has their own objectives and goals, so they might not share everything that you would want to know. Well, I state that differently. They don't share everything you might want to know to be effective at search engine optimization. But really the key thing is to recognize that it starts with the fact that the search engine is a software program.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got a team of software programmers sitting in Mountain View and other places on the globe who are writing algorithms that are trying to parse websites that, I mean, we know of trillions of web pages implemented by hundreds of thousands of development teams using hundreds of different development systems. And, you know, anything and everything shows up as a website out there.
Right.
And it's actually not as easy to parse and analyze as you might think.
I would say that it's extremely complicated.
Yes.
And actually, that's one of the things that comes down to it. Like, when someone asks me what to do to make their website better, what I know is that there's a very large company, Google, with a lot of smart people trying to figure out how to provide the best content when somebody searches, right? So they're doing a lot of the work for you in the sense that what Google's plan is that you don't have to do anything to your website. You just have to provide it. They will figure out what's worthy and hand it off to the person. And what you're saying is you really have to understand that system a little bit better. Try to parse it through and look at that to figure out how to best situate your content so that Google do that well. And the trick, of course, of that is that people have, and let's back up for a second and just kind of mention that it's not uncommon for people to try to game the system. They'll try to produce a whole bunch of subdomains that'll link back so that they've got a lot more link counts, and Google detects that and kind of punishes you for it. So there's this war games aspect of it. And that's a space that you and I would agree you want to stay away from because it's not effective.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The way I look at it is if you're trying to fool Google into giving you traffic, right, by going too far,
yeah,
then you're putting your business at risk. And, you know, I know for my part, I've got employees, you know, people who, like, depend on their, you know, paying their rent and their, you know, getting food for their family and things like that, you know, based on the income they're getting from us. And I don't think it's right for me to put that at risk because I'm trying to fool Google into giving me more business than I deserve, right?
Yeah.
I want to try to learn the right way to do things so that I can grow steadily and securely over time.
So the search engines, the complexity is so great, I would think, that even a developer that's been there for a few years doesn't really understand how it all works. Wouldn't you agree that it's at that level of complexity?
Yes. I'll actually put that a little bit differently.
Okay.
I've been... doing SEO for 10 plus years and fairly well known in the industry.
Sure.
And I know some of how it works.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I spend all my time doing nothing but trying to solve that problem.
It's interesting because Google's first kind of clever way of thinking about search engine was to say, well, you know what? The more people link to content on the web, the more valuable it probably is. And so there's this link rating. And when they did that, they slaughtered AltaVista, right? They just really did a great job. And the Google search engine became extremely effective. And that's why we all switched to it, right? And before that, Yahoo was doing this amazing thing of actually having people rank and categorize pages, right? So they had this giant system that tried to classify content and use that as part of their search results. So you kind of understood that if you were talking about underwater basket weaving, there were other pages about underwater basket weaving, and they knew that because somebody had actually visited. That became untenable, of course, as the web got large enough. So now it is all derived from algorithms that are complicated enough that I would assume that no human being understands all of them, at least. You know, they understand bits of it. And that, to me, is kind of an amazing thing. Google indexing is kind of a emergent, or Google's search engine is kind of an emergent, has an emergent quality to it. It's complex enough that you can't know exactly why it did what it did. Now, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm putting too much magic into it. But it feels to me at that level.
No, I think you're right about the level. It is definitely an intense level of complexity. So when going back to your original question, when I think about search engine optimization and, you know, what it is and what people need to do about it, the first thing is to recognize that there are certain things you can do without resorting to spam practices or mm-hmm. black hat practices, in mm-hmm. the SEO way of thinking of that term, to help the search engine better understand what the pages of your site are about.
Right.
Okay. So that's kind of step one. And
can we in that step one, can I go ahead and do my completely layman's perspective in the sense that I'm a web developer for years, but I've never read an SEO book except for yours and only partially get ready to talk to you. so let me give you my kind of rule of thumb of what to do on a site. And you go ahead and tell me what I'm missing and what's wrong about that. It used to be that sure. keywords were a big thing. I ignore keywords completely in headers. So with the things that I do is make sure my page title denotes what the page is about. I have a good H1 that's basically a mirror of the page title. So I'm duplicating the main content idea.
Main heading.
Yeah.
H1. Yeah.
I'm making sure that I don't have duplicate copies of the same story on my site from different URL paths, unless it's an abstract of some sort that then links to the main story. And I would do that with the headline. And then of course, the content I write, I do think about that content as I'm writing it. I make sure all my links on the web in general, all descriptive text links, not click here. Click here is a bad way to do things, and that's just in general. You instead say, take a look at Ben's wonderful haircut instead of click here to look at Ben's wonderful haircut, right? So that the word wonderful haircut actually shows up as the link to kind of give reference to that image, give a reason for that image or a meaning to the image. And then, of course, the site itself should have a site map, which is a XML document that Google kind of uses to determine how quickly it's going to crawl the site. And that's really important when you've got something like a blog or something that's updating regularly to kind of assist in the indexing state. That's pretty much all I recommend to people. And of course, if there are a hair designer in Santa Cruz, it should say Santa Cruz, and it should have contact information, and it should have about hair design. And if the person is really on top of it, they should write some blog entries about things they think about hair design, so they become kind of a content creator in their domain-specific area. That's my, you know, elevator pitch of SEO. How'd I do?
So well. You did quite well. There's a few things I would tweak.
I'm all
one, in terms of the meta keyword tag, you're dead on. Ignore it. Search engines haven't used them for 8 years because spammers ruin that.
and what we're talking about is inside the hidden part of the web page, HTML document,
right.
There's an area called meta tags, and you can add content there. And there's this meta type called keyword. And the idea would be that if on GeekSpeak we have the keywords technology and Windows and OS 10 and all these different feature sets we talk about, viruses, passwords, public radio, all these things would be things we talk about. Therefore, we make a list of them on every one of our web pages, and then the searching index can go, ooh, if I want to know about technology, I just go to geekspeak.org because they clearly state this. What happened is people took advantage of that early on, just put all these bogus words just to get people to get to their site, and they kind of destroyed that feature. So
that's
keywords
right.
are gone.
The meta keywords thing, which appears in the head section of your HTML, is worthless. Don't spend time on it. Don't let anyone tell you to spend time on it, unless you're just looking for busy work and don't care about helping. Skip that part. and there is another element in there, though, that is important called the meta description tag. It's in the same section of the website, the hidden part, if you called it, or the head section of the HTML. And what the meta description is useful for is it's often used by the search engine, by Google, as the description for your web page that you see in the search results.
So if
you write an effective meta description, it might entice more click-throughs on your page in the search results than someone else's.
So if you're searching for amazing haircuts and you find Ben's page in one of the pages that Google returns, if the description talks about Chinese gophers, then no one's going to click on that to determine about good haircuts.
What are you saying about my haircut?
I'm saying you look like a Chinese gopher. Oh. You know, it's just was the inference unclear? I'm sorry.
No, I just wanted to clarify.
Okay, I'm really pulling random things out, by the way, Ben. I think your haircut's awesome.
I mean, that's exactly right, and of course to be slightly more precise, because you would never put that in your meta description, right? But it's an opportunity to describe to the user the benefit that they'll get by clicking on your link.
Mm-hmm.
And what we know from practical testing experience is that you really should view it as an opportunity to do a little bit of selling, but not a hard sell.
Right.
Internet users don't like hard sells in their search results. But just something that talks about the benefits of, you know, what are you going to get?
Right.
If you get that, you can influence your click-through rate.
Okay, so that's a really important thing. It's not actually about getting the index higher or your importance higher in your rankings or anything, but it is about making sure the person knows what to expect. Does that meta description, is that site-wide or page-specific?
Page by page. So
okay.
On each page of the website, you should have one of these. And by the way, it should differ for each page.
Right, it should be descriptive of that page.
That's
one thing we're not doing. So I'm, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to totally take all the recommendations you have and implement it in the new GeekSpeak website, which I'm working on, this is awesome. I didn't even realize how selfish this is going to be great. But let me just say that, does that mean that something like WordPress or you know, another blog tool like that actually knows that and it's built into the system that the abstract, if you will, of the blog post actually shows up in the meta description? Or is that something that you have to tune for a WordPress install? Do you know?
Yeah, in the case of WordPress, it's best to write your own custom meta description, and you typically, what that means, because WordPress doesn't really have this built in, you have to install a plugin for WordPress that enables you to do that.
Okay, and so then what you're talking about is every time you write a blog, you have another field that kind of is what the search result would show if this page showed up. Which is a very different thing than the introduction to the story or the abstract of the story. It's a very specific type of word and a type of language. And I would assume you go into great details on meta description, how to write them, how to form them in your book, SEO, The Art of SEO, correct?
Yes, we do.
All right.
A couple of things I wanted to mention about your overview.
Mm-hmm.
One, you mentioned the title tag, which is also in the hidden part of the HTML. And that's also incredibly important. In fact, it's probably the most important thing, right? And you want to make sure that you have, whatever the unique aspect is of that web page, prominently featured in the title.
Right.
We typically advise that you put it on the left side, and if you want to broadcast your brand, that's great. But put it at the end of the tag, search engines try to look at that as a little
so what we're talking about is when when you do a Google search, a search on a search engine, and you hit a whole bunch of lists, there's descriptions that we just talked about in meta description, but then there's the actual link itself that links to the page. That comes from your title. And if you always, on every single one of the pages, start it with GeekSpeak, 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 and nobody knows what that means, instead you talk, in this show's title, for example, should be Search Engine Optimization with Eric Inga, colon GeekSpeak, or pipe GeekSpeak. So GeekSpeak's the brand is still there on the right-hand side, but isn't the prominent feature of the page, because, of course, that's not what the page is about. The page is about the content that you're currently writing. Okay, very cool.
Yeah, and it also actually, by the way, again, it shows up in the search results, so it influences people's click-through rate, because they tend to start reading, at least in countries like the United States, on the left, right? So, and if they just finish typing in search engine optimization, well, you know, it impacts them. They're more likely to click on it.
Yeah. Up on the left. You know, I've been wanting to ask somebody this a long time. When we started doing a lot more CSS design websites, there was a method called Fourier replacement. Is that how you pronounce it, Ben? I've never actually pronounced it.
There's
Fourier
several replacement. Kinds of, there's scalable Inman.
Yeah, and the general idea would be that you might want a really beautiful image like your logo to show up as a major element on your page. But really, for a text reader, you want an H1, a main content type, to talk about what the page is. So what I've always been curious about is, are these search engines, and the way you do this is you hide the text, you put a background image of your logo where that text would be. So it's still a link, it's still an H1, it still has text in it. If you look at the HTML, it's very well formatted for searching. But then in the CSS, you actually hide that and display an image. Now, that could be, that means that a human being's experience is different than a search engine's experience. The question I have is, do Google systems actually look, does a search engine system actually look at that and go, wait a second, this is being replaced? Does it care? Does it know?
The technique you were talking about, scalable Inman flash replacement, is one of the techniques. I think there's a few of them, actually. First of all, it is a generally accepted method when used within certain limits.
Mm-hmm.
This notion of having text on the web page, which the search engine can see and users can't, is generally speaking frowned upon and given the label of cloaking.
Right.
But in the case of scalable Inman flash replacement, which we sometimes abbreviate CIFR, what happens is that the text that is search engine visible is actually what's used to generate the text in the image.
Right.
So there's a direct relationship, and that's something that the search engines are very comfortable with, because there's a one-to-one correspondence between what showed up in the image and what showed up in the...
Of course, assuming the search engine can figure that out. And what I'm talking actually about, I don't particularly put flash on web pages. I just don't like the whole system. I get away from that completely. And I'm talking about PNG images, right? Just a really pretty graphic of your logo that is an image, and replacing the text with an image by using a CSS like text indent -2000. That kind of thing, where the text is actually still in line in the document. It's actually not being visible hidden. It's actually being moved off to the side to put an image in its place that is comparable content. That's kind of what I'm talking about. And what you're saying is that that's in that space where we're not really sure necessarily what Google does. Is that true?
Well, let's put it this way. You are in the very dangerous space.
Interesting.
You're, you know, hiding things off screen by, you know, absolute position, you know, -2000, as you say. Or for that example, another example would be having text the same color as the background of the page. So,
right.
White text on a white background.
Right. But at the same point, highly designed sites have this kind of content all the time.
Like Apple.com, for example, which a lot
of the entire
web world kind of follows in terms of aesthetics, uses image replacement, I know, for their navigation at the top, where they hide the actual text, but then they show images of a method I use
most of the time. Of course, I always push people to use real text, and it's getting better and easier to do so now that we are actually enabling to use web fonts, right? We can start doing a lot better.
You can't do inner shadows and things like that.
No, there are definitely things you can't do. You can do Photoshop, you can't do in HTML and CSS.
Yeah,
all right, but you're definitely saying that that's a dangerous area, potentially.
It's definitely a dangerous area. What happens with these things is that, let's say you do a little bit of that on a few pages on your site, and your site has a lot of other things about it that suggest that it's a really good quality site. The chances are that Google will note that and say, well, all the other things are positive signals, so there isn't enough here for us really concerned about.
Right.
But when you have enough of those kinds of things which are sort of in the questionable area, the cumulative weight of those signals is what causes them to get concerned. So
yeah.
you can go to Amazon and you'll find things that Amazon does that you know, aren't ideal from an SEO perspective. You know, Amazon isn't going to get booted out of the index. It's
right.
way too authoritative a site.
Right.
Right. So there's a balance going on, and it's just best in general to not do too many of the questionable things so that you put the balance in the wrong.
The book is The Art of SEO, Mastering Search Engine Optimization. The lead author, I would say, is Eric Inge, but there's actually a list of four people that do this space.
That's right.
In this book. I'm not going to list them out, but please feel free to pick up this book. It's by O'Reilly. Wonderful discussion with you about search engine. It's much too short, but I do want to offer to you maybe something else you'd like to touch upon before we run out of time completely.
You know, I think the one other thing that I just wanted to mention from your original outline that's useful for people to think about is for each major benefit or service that they are trying to promote with their website,
mm-hmm.
that they should have a separate web page for each one, because
right.
the title tag is so important
right.
that having a site structure that and it speaks to each of the various products, services, and or benefits as perceived by the user.
Right. So
really
so if you have let's say the dentist website, you have a list of services the dentist provides, you know, fillings and, I don't know, other dental things, right?
You'd want root canal.
You'd want every one of those pages, you'd want a page for every one of those that really specifically talks about that service so that when someone's searching for root canals in Santa Cruz, for example, they'd find the page that talks about root canals in Santa Cruz from that dentist.
That's right.
Right.
Because that makes
cool.
it much more likely that the Google will decide that you're relevant to that than if you had root canals mentioned somewhere buried in the text on a page along with 12 other services.
Right. I remember long ago I started doing photographs of friends, and I just put a page, their name, the title, a photograph of them, a short bio, and it was on one page, had everything. It became the premier search index for that person. It always was the photo that showed up. And it was just a very simple thing like that, you know, that allowed it to say, this page is about this one content area. If you're interested in that one content, it's the only page on the internet like that. Of course, Facebook and Twitter kind of destroyed that ranking because now there are pages about everybody. Let me ask you, well, we're really short on it. So I guess I'll say that you have some wonderful quick videos. You have training tutorials and such. You offer classes and you do events. I'm going to be following you regularly to learn more about search engine optimization. And Eric, I really appreciate you being here on GeekSpeak today.
I appreciate the opportunity.
Eric Inge, he is one of the authors of Mastering the Art of SEO. The Art of SEO, Mastering Search Engine Optimization. Eric, thank you so much for joining us on GeekSpeak.
My pleasure.
Take care.
Yep, bye.
Too short, as it always is here on GeekSpeak. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence. It's used with permission. Streaming and podcasting at kusp.org. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KSP Santa Cruz. My name's Lyle Troxel. In the air with me is Ben Jaffe and Lindsay Lonnie. Hey, thanks for being here today, guys.
Thank you.
I got some work to do on the GeekSpeak website to get search engine optimized.
Indeed.